This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In July 2014, Christopher Barnett robbed a convenience store in Douglas, Georgia. He fled the scene. Soon after, Barnett shot and wounded a police officer who had stopped his vehicle. Later, Barnett wandered onto Amy Corbett's front lawn, where she was playing with her six children, including her son. Police pursuing, Barnett ordered everyone on the ground. At one point, the family dog entered the scene. Deputy Michael Vickers fired two shots at the dog, and one of those bullets hit Amy Corbett's 10-year-old son in the back of the knee. Well, she sued the police. She sought $2 million in damages, not only for her son's pain and suffering, but also for the suffering of her other children, who each had an officer shoving the barrel of a loaded gun into their back, according to the lawsuit. But in July 2019, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals dismissed Corbett's case against the officer who shot her son. Well, Joanna Schwartz, I want to start with you today. What was the federal court's justification for preventing Amy Corbett from collecting civil damages from the officers in this Georgia case?
The court's decision to dismiss Amy Corbett's case was based on the doctrine of qualified immunity. And the way that the court explained qualified immunity worked, relying on Supreme Court cases, the court said that a case like this needs to be dismissed unless there's a prior court decision with nearly identical facts. And the Supreme Court had made clear, it was very clear to the court that was hearing Amy Corbett's case, that you cannot use excessive force against a person who is not a threat. But what the court said was there had not been a prior court decision with similar facts where a police officer had shot at someone who was on the ground as they were attempting to hit someone else, and or the dog in this case, and therefore there was no clearly established right that was violated.
Okay, that is fascinating. Well, that is Joanna Schwartz. She's a professor of law at UCLA. And this hour, we want to learn about exactly what qualified immunity is, why there seems to be gathering momentum to reform it, and also why this concept even exists in American law. And Professor Schwartz is going to help us do that. So first of all, Professor Schwartz, can you just give us, like, what is the definition, the legal definition of qualified immunity?
Sure. Happy to do that and happy to be here. Qualified immunity is a doctrine that the Supreme Court created in 1967. At the time, they called it a good faith immunity for constitutional violations. But now the way the court has defined qualified immunity, it protects government officers, including law enforcement, from damages. Civil damages, so it doesn't apply to criminal cases, unless an officer has violated what the court calls clearly established law.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you mentioned that 1967 case. We actually have a little bit of sound from a person who was one of the counsels in that case. Again, the case is Pearson versus Ray. And if I understand correctly, the story actually really begins with the passage of the Ku Klux Klan Act back in 1871, an act that held that victims had the power to sue anyone acting, quote, under color of any law, statute, ordinance, regulation, or custom who violates their constitutional rights. But Professor Schwartz, as you're saying, that changes come 1967 with Pearson versus Ray. And the backdrop is that a group of white and black priests were arrested for entering a whites-only area of a bus terminal in Jackson, Mississippi. And their civil suit is the one we're talking about, which made it to the Supreme Court. Well, lawyer Elizabeth Watkins Hewlin Grayson represented the officers, and here she is laying out what she saw as the main issues in the case.
Whether or not there is a partial or limited immunity to police officers who act in good faith with reasonable grounds to believe, which is a question of fact, with reasonable grounds to believe that the statute was being violated, that they had probable cause, which, as I state, is a question of fact.
Okay, so Professor Schwartz, there's actually a lot going on there, right? So first of all, describe to me what Grayson is talking about when she talks about acting in good faith with reasonable grounds to believe that their actions are lawful.
Well, at the time, in the Pearson versus Ray case, the law enforcement officers who arrested the white and black clergymen were acting to enforce a Mississippi law that was later found to be unconstitutional. And so in this case, the lawyer is saying the officers were arresting these men under this law that was later proved unconstitutional, but they were acting in good faith to enforce this law. That's what they're saying at this moment.
Okay. So the key thing is the officers need to believe they're acting in good faith to enforce a law that's extant at the time.
Yes, that was what – I mean, again, qualified immunity is a shapeshifter.
Yeah.
And what the doctrine is has dramatically changed over time. At that moment, that was what the court was – or excuse me, what the lawyer was arguing before the court.
Okay, so let's see how that sort of – that chimeric aspect of qualified immunity does shift over time. 1983, Harlow versus Fitzgerald, where the Supreme Court expands the definition of qualified immunity, and the cases that I believe Ernest Fitzgerald believed he was fired from his job from the United States Air Force because of whistleblower testimony he gave to Congress in 1969. He sues government officials, so this isn't even really a law enforcement case. And lawyer Herbert Miller argued that President Nixon and those government officials deserved immunity.
I don't care how popular the president may have been, but during the course of his administration, decisions are made. He does things which are not looked with favor by some portion of the public, and he is in a very difficult position when it comes to actually going before a jury of his peers in a civil lawsuit.
Okay, so Professor Schwartz, this is fascinating to me because we begin this conversation in the context of law enforcement, right, in 1967. But then and now in 2021, I think most people, when they think of qualified immunity, are thinking of it in the context of law enforcement. But it got expanded after the fact to all government officials?
Well, it's qualified immunity has been understood really from the beginning as protecting so-called executive branch officials. So that includes law enforcement and others. And I should say, although this is a conversation about qualified immunity, the reason that executives have this, it's in comparison to judicial officers and legislators who have absolute immunity. Probably a conversation for another a day. But those, if you're a judge or a legislator, you have absolute immunity, cannot be sued at all for anything that you do in your capacity as a judge or legislator. But executives, in contrast, have only a qualified immunity. But that applies to, I mean, we do talk a lot about, of course, policing for all sorts of reasons and their qualified immunity and what impact that has. But all executive government officials have that immunity, and including federal officials and as well as state and local.
Okay. So just to be sure that I understand this correctly, qualified immunity, again, keeping the focus on law enforcement, for example, is immunity from civil prosecution or seeking or a victim seeking civil damages if a law enforcement officer takes action that he or she believes does not violate someone's constitutional rights. Is that a good way of summarizing it?
Well, I endorse the first half of what you said. It is a protection in civil damages claims. So civil claims seeking money. against law enforcement officers. The way that the Supreme Court has talked about this standard, first they talked in Pearson, as you mentioned, about officers' good faith intents. In Harlow, they changed the standard to talk about clearly established law. But part of what the court did in Harlow is say that an officer's good faith intent doesn't matter in the qualified immunity analysis. An officer can think that they're violating the law, and that belief isn't relevant to qualified immunity. The only question, as the Supreme Court has repeatedly told lower courts, is whether there's a prior court decision with virtually identical facts. And so even if there are examples of in the Supreme Court's cases of officers who knew that they were going over the line, but because there was not a prior court decision that had virtually identical facts, the Supreme Court says the law is not clearly established.
That is spectacularly narrow, isn't it?
It is spectacularly narrow. That's a very good way to put it.
Okay.
And given the example that you discussed at the beginning of the hour with Baxter versus Bracey, a man who had a police dog released upon him when he was sitting on the ground with his hands in the air, he was granted qualified immunity, even though there was a prior court decision from that very same court where that court said it was unconstitutional to release a police dog on a man who was lying down in surrender because of those factual differences.
Well, so now we've taken this walk through a half century of law in the United States about how qualified immunity has shape-shifted and changed as a legal concept in this country. When we come back, we're going to talk about the new shape it might be taking on as efforts to rethink, reform qualified immunity gather steam across this country. So, Professor Schwartz, stand by for just a moment. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about both national and state-level efforts to reform the concept of qualified immunity. That's the legal doctrine that protects many law enforcement officers from civil lawsuits. And I'm joined today by Joanna Schwartz. She's a professor of law at the UCLA School of Law. And Professor Schwartz, we're going to dive in through the rest of this hour to some specific ongoing efforts to rethink qualified immunity. But before we do that, I just want to ask you, broadly speaking, two things. One is, have you seen this kind of momentum to sort of reexamine qualified immunity before? And two, what is this one might be kind of obvious, but I want to hear what your answer is. What is really driving this new momentum?
Great questions. The first one is easy to answer. The answer is no. I have not seen any momentum resembling this. And qualified immunity has been in existence since 1967. And even as it's gotten stronger and stronger, the objections to the doctrine have really been raised by lawyers and by academics. In the latest presidential campaign, there were some Democratic candidates who included reform of qualified immunity to their list of criminal justice reforms, which, you know, was surprising and very welcome for those of us who have studied this issue. But qualified immunity really broke onto the national scene after the killing of George Floyd in May of 2020. And there you started seeing signs lifted in protest across the country saying end qualified immunity. Mm-hmm. And If I could diagnose why it is that qualified immunity has really taken center stage in discussions about police accountability, I think that the obvious injustice and really unsensible nature of the doctrine, the idea that someone would be denied relief simply because they had the bad luck of not being able to find a prior court decision with virtually identical facts, and the really tragic and horrific facts of cases in which people were denied relief because of qualified immunity, I think has gathered so much steam behind reform of the doctrine. But it's also worth noting that there are many, many other barriers to relief in these cases. And so although qualified immunity absolutely deserves the top billing that it's receiving in conversations about police accountability and reform, ending qualified immunity on its own will not usher in a golden age of police accountability. There are many other aspects of the system to fix.
Right. I was going to ask you about that. So I'm glad that you mentioned it, because it seems to be in line with other efforts. For example, the movement to get body-worn cameras on more police officers. There was the same sort of hope that it would go a long way towards producing greater accountability. It goes partially. I mean, it's not a meaningless change. It's a meaningful one, but not perhaps as you were saying. There's no magic wand here. But also, I want to be attentive to details and facts and be sure that we're discussing this with the utmost clarity, because again, we're talking about the ability to bring civil suits against police officers in this case regarding qualified immunity. But I think folks might be wondering, well, in Minneapolis, the family of George Floyd reached a historic $27 million settlement with the city of Minneapolis, though. So that actually legally is a separate issue.
Well, there's two important things that your example and the discussion of the settlement in George Floyd's case is worth noting. One is that qualified immunity has not been an issue in any of the cases that have really shaped our public consciousness about police violence in the last several years. That is not because qualified immunity doesn't matter. It is because these very high-profile cases are not litigated. They are settled usually quickly because of the massive public protest. And so qualified immunity comes in and does its work on the many, many cases that you may not have heard of, but that also involve real extreme injustices. Your readers or your viewers, listeners may not have heard about Amy Corbett's case or Alexander Baxter's case. Those are the cases where qualified immunity does its work. It's also really important to think about the $27 million settlement in George Floyd's case or in any of the other case resolutions that we see when you note that this money is coming from the local government and not from the individual officer. Much of the debate right now about qualified immunity and defenses of qualified immunity sound in the notion that officers will be bankrupted if we get rid of qualified immunity doctrine. But there's actually an entirely separate protection for officers' bank accounts that has nothing to do with qualified immunity. These are state and local indemnification policies. Mm. These are laws that require that local governments pay for lawyers and for settlements and judgments in cases against officers. And when I studied who actually pays settlements and judgments in police misconduct cases across the country over a six-year period, I found that 99.98% of the dollars were paid by local governments. 0.02% of the dollars were paid by officers. I found two of the 81 jurisdictions where officers had ever been required to pay anything, and the average they were ever required to pay was $2,000. Those are in cases where the plaintiffs got past qualified immunity. So even without qualified immunity, officers bank accounts are going to be protected.
Okay. So we're going to come back to this issue in a moment because sort of who in reform efforts, who would get sued and who would pay is actually one of the sticking points in Congress. So we're going to talk about that in a second. But I did want to actually for a moment narrow the focus to what's happening in one state, because there are congressional level efforts, and also, as we've been mentioning, there's consideration in a lot of state houses across the country, including in the state of Maine, because Maine is considering two bills that would either reform or fully eliminate qualified immunity. And when Maine State Police Major Brian Scott thinks about that, thinks about qualified immunity, he goes back to an incident that occurred early in his 27-year-long career. He told us about it. He was responding to a domestic violence emergency in Halliwell, Maine. He had no backup, and he arrived at the scene alone and climbed the stairs to the residence.
I'm looking at his feet, and they're spread slightly, and I can see past those inside the residence. And I see a female laying on the ground in the fetal position, covering her face with blood running across her hands.
So Scott told us he wanted to get to the woman, but the male suspect would not move. So Scott pushed him against the wall, and the two fought.
He was throwing furniture around. He was throwing lamps around, and he dragged me around the living room, and I couldn't let go of him. Finally, I mustered what strength I had when we got to a standing position, and I tried to execute what I was trained to do during the academy, which is a type of trip technique so that I could get him on the ground face down. That's what we consider all their weapons are down if I can get him face down. But when I was swinging him from a standing position and working my way to the ground, I hit his head on a coffee table. I didn't mean to hit his head on a coffee table. That was an accident, but it cut his head and left him with a welt and some redness and a little bit of bleeding.
Well, Major Scott says he feels that qualified immunity protected him in that situation because he was adhering to his training and to department policy. Now he's worried about the proposed changes to the doctrine in Maine.
You're no longer supported. That's the message that we hear. The very lawmakers who make the laws and ask us to enforce them are the very ones who are now contemplating in the state of Maine whether or not they should remove qualified immunity.
Scott told us the debate over qualified immunity is personal because of the high levels of risk he and his colleagues face in the line of duty. Risks that he says young officers do not learn in the recruitment process.
They don't tell us that our life expectancy is going to be 57 years of age or 21 years younger than civilians. They don't talk about how PTSD will haunt us. They don't talk about the nights, weekends, and holidays that you're going to miss from your family. They don't talk about the times you're going to miss your toddler's first steps, which it does happen. Sorry about that. So when you add all these things up, that's just doing the job.
But Scott says he believes that officers who commit high-profile cases of police brutality should be held accountable, and that there's already a mechanism in place to do that, criminal court.
One time is one too many time. Please, I'm not going to understate that it's not okay, that we have had horrible things happen to citizens and persons of color in the United States, in our very, in our own country here, that are unacceptable, that should not have happened. However, there are millions of encounters that happen with law enforcement and citizens every day of persons of colors or the elderly or the youthful or people that are wealthy or people that are poor, folks from all walks of life that have very good encounters with police. And we don't hear about those so often because they're not newsworthy. It's just what we do day in and day out.
That's Major Brian Scott of the Maine State Police. He's also legislative liaison to the Maine State Police Criminal Justice and Public Safety Committee. So, Professor Schwartz, let me turn back to you. And first of all, I'm curious to understand, say Maine moves forward and fully eliminates qualified immunity. I don't know if that's going to happen, but they're considering it. Are there other protections in place that would have, say, shielded Major Scott from liability in that story that he told us about in his response to the domestic abuse call?
There absolutely are. And first, I should say I'm very sympathetic to Major Scott's concerns. I just don't think that they are properly or accurately focused on the doctrine of qualified immunity. He described that story and said he felt that with qualified immunity, you'd no longer be supported for the conduct that he did in that case. As a matter of fact, the United States Supreme Court has interpreted the Constitution, the Fourth Amendment, which is the amendment in the Bill of Rights that is the protection against excessive force, has already interpreted that constitutional protection to protect Major Scott in those circumstances. The Supreme Court's case Graham versus Connor sort of sets out what the standard is when thinking about excessive force. And what the court has said is that an officer has not violated the Constitution if they act reasonably. And when assessing reasonableness, you look at the totality of the circumstances. You recognize that an officer is making split-second decisions, and courts are instructed by the Supreme Court to judge officers' conduct from the perspective of a reasonable officer on the scene rather than with the 2020 vision of hindsight. That is the language from the Supreme Court and their direction to lower courts when they think about whether officers have violated the Constitution. I'm not a judge, but my assessment is, given the facts as he has described them, his conduct was reasonable under the circumstances. And so it was not qualified immunity that would protect him. It was the Constitution itself. Qualified immunity is not necessary to protect him from civil liability in those circumstances. And even if he was found to have violated the Constitution, indemnification rules that provide that local governments pay damages levied against officers would almost certainly kick in under those circumstances. So he actually had two layers of protection, the Constitution and indemnification protections, wholly apart from qualified immunity.
I see.
But I do take point that he says he doesn't feel supported. And I think that that is more about the rhetoric of qualified immunity and what defenders of qualified immunity are saying, mm-hmm. which is just objectively untrue.
Let's take that line of questioning then to what's happening in Congress. Professor Schwartz, because now twice the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act has passed the House. It's stuck a little bit in the Senate due to disagreements between Republicans and Democrats about if there are to be reforms in qualified immunity, right? Who would be the target of those civil lawsuits, right? The individual police officers or the departments themselves, the police departments themselves. Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. So qualified immunity protects individual officers. Right now, you can bring a case against an individual officer and you have to get past qualified immunity. There's a separate way of bringing lawsuits against the police department or the local government. That is a separate kind of claim that has its own challenges that are almost as difficult, frankly, as qualified immunity to get past. What the Justice and Policing Act is hoping to do is eliminate qualified immunity so that people can bring claims against individual officers. My understanding about the Republican option is that that's been described in general terms by Senator Tim Scott, is that the claims would go directly against the police department or local government. And so it sounds like what they're suggesting is that we would not have qualified immunity, but that there would also not be claims that could be brought against the individual officers. The claims would just be brought against the local government.
Okay. You know, it's interesting because this issue is bringing together kind of an unexpected group of folks who normally you might not think would be aligned on these kinds of policy issues. Because if I understand correctly, you know, like the Cato Institute, taking a very libertarian stance, does not like the idea that police departments would be on the hook for civil damages, because ultimately, according to them, taxpayers would pay those dollars. They want the focus to stay on the removal of or the ability for people to sue individual officers. What do you think about that?
Well, my understanding from conversations with the Cato folks is, you know, they do want to make sure that there is still an avenue for individual accountability for the officers, and simply making this a claim against local governments would take the focus away from what individual officers have done. So I appreciate that concern. But these are problems of individuals and also problems of systems. And I think both should be held to account.
Hmm. Well, Professor Schwartz, stand by. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about public health tools and measures that will be needed to continue to open up the United States, specifically if this country never reaches so-called vaccine-mediated herd immunity. It's something that public health experts are beginning to say could happen. So we want to hear from you. Have the goals and guidance on managing the pandemic right now, have they been clear to you? And if you're seeing different measures for those who are vaccinated versus those who are not, has that changed how you behave? What's your question now at this point in the pandemic? Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Today, we are talking about the legal doctrine of qualified immunity, specifically regarding law enforcement and the gathering momentum across the country to change that legal doctrine. I'm joined today by Joanna Schwartz, professor of law at UCLA School of Law. She's been talking us through the history of qualified immunity through congressional efforts and reforms being considered at the state level. And Professor Schwartz, if I may, I'd actually like to focus on another state that actually did make some changes in the past year or so. So let's go to Colorado, where Colorado State Representative Leslie Herod joins us from Denver. Representative Herod is chair of the Colorado Black Democratic Legislative Caucus, and last year she helped lead the effort to reform qualified immunity in Colorado. Representative Herod, welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
So first of all, tell us, what did you change in Colorado law?
Well, last year with Senate Bill 217, immediately after the murder of George Floyd and the uprisings that happened across the country, including right here in Denver, we passed a bill that ended qualified immunity for local law enforcement officers at the state level. Additionally, we required personal responsibility for law enforcement officers who act in bad faith of up to $25,000. So they personally would have to pay $25,000 into any settlement or any judgment against them for, again, acting in bad faith and harming someone in our communities. Our measure was passed with bipartisan support. Democrats and Republicans both signed on to this provision, as well as the entire bill, which had other police reform measures in it as well. And quite frankly, it wasn't opposed by any law enforcement lobby in the Capitol. Now, not saying they were supportive, but they were not opposed. And I believe it was clear across the state of Colorado that people wanted to make sure that law enforcement officers were personally responsible for doing harm in the community, especially when they knew the harm they were doing and that harm was intentional.
Okay, so that's that $25,000 piece of it at the individual level. Is there, and was there any cap put in place for damages, civil damages that could be sought? Are you saying to departments themselves?
There was not. Okay. No, because, you know, it's really hard to put a number on someone's life.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, most of the cases that come up are when someone's life has been taken, like Elijah McClain, who was murdered in Aurora, or Devon Bailey, who was shot in the back while running away in Colorado Springs. And so we can't put a cap on someone's life. And we want to make sure that families actually have justice and the recourse that they think is best. But we also want to make sure that this indemnification piece does not absolve an officer completely of their personal responsibility and liability to that family. And so we said that that officer had to personally pay that $25,000, not through their employer. Now, could they get personal insurance to cover this? Yes. And I think I welcome that. I think that might be a very good idea. But we wanted to have some personal responsibility. And so, quite frankly, to the people of Colorado.
Mm-hmm. And so let me ask you, because I want to be sure that I'm hearing all of this correctly. For the personal responsibility piece, did you say that the officers would have, they would have to have knowingly acted in bad faith?
There is a bad faith provision, and the knowingly standard is interesting. And I'm not an attorney, and so I look forward to hearing the conversation about how it's interpreted. But there is a bad faith provision. And so basically, you know, that officer has to act in bad faith, going against the law, going against their training, going above and beyond, right, to do harm in the community. And this is not just for abuse or serious bodily injury or things like that, or death. It's also for illegal search and seizure, any violation of someone's constitutional rights. If they act outside of the scope of their duties, if they act outside of the scope of the law, they will be held accountable.
I see. Okay. So, Professor Schwartz, let me turn back to you. First of all, your response to the changes made by Representative Herod and obviously the state of Colorado how important is the personal liability piece?
I should say at the outset, I think that the bill in Colorado is a model for future, for other states, and really applaud Representative Herod and the rest of the folks that were involved in the passage of this bill. I think that it's tremendous politically because, as she just explained, they were able to get this bill passed quickly and without the kinds of extended fights that have happened in other state legislatures. But I think the bill is also worth acknowledging and holding up because of this indemnification provision. One thing I love about this bill is that it's not just about qualified immunity. It recognizes that qualified immunity is one piece of a larger puzzle. And one of those pieces that is extremely important is creating some level of personal accountability for officers when they are found to have acted in bad faith, which this does. It also requires that local governments pay the remainder unless the officer has been criminally convicted. And that combination of mandated government payment and individual officer contribution means that the paired goals of compensation and deterrence can be met with this statute.
Interesting. Representative Herod, let me turn back to you, because you said that law enforcement groups in Colorado, they didn't necessarily support the change, but they didn't oppose it either. Did that surprise you? Because I think, you know, as Professor Schwartz has been talking to us about the history of any previous conversation around qualified immunity, there's been very vociferous opposition to it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It did surprise me. I did not introduce this bill with the intent of having law enforcement support. I'm going to be honest with you. While we have some law enforcement officers across the country, including chiefs of police, like my chief here in Denver, Paul Pazin, who are working to reform policing and to end, including ending qualified immunity, the vast majority of law enforcement does not support these types of changes, especially on the qualified immunity provisions. And so I did not expect their support. But again, the public the public cry for change from Democrats, Republicans, independents really made a difference in shaping our bill, and we were able to gather support. And so, you know, I remind folks who are listening that the movement for Black lives and the movement to value people in the community, right, and to value our lives, all of our lives, is not over, right? It didn't end last summer. It must continue. And if we want to get these types of measures passed across the country and keep all of us safe, we have to keep activating. We have to keep talking about it. We cannot let these hashtags continue, right? People's names who have passed. And instead, we should know any of these people's names, right? And we should know no more names, because we want to end police brutality that's happening in our communities and hold those bad officers accountable. I mean, I do think that when we're talking about reimagining policing, it does have to be a combination of that accountability and deterrence. And quite frankly, I think we've struck that balance here in Colorado, but there is so much more work to do. And we will continue that work. We are committed to ensuring that our officers that are on the streets are truly there to serve and protect and not to do harm.
Mm. Professor Schwartz, so many questions for both of you. I'm curious about how there's still, I mean, maybe this is just a fact of what the law is in a modern society. There still seems to be so much subject to interpretation, even now in Colorado, because I heard it mentioned that to be held personally accountable, an officer would have to do something that was clearly against the law or against their training. Now, in the case of the murder of George Floyd, we heard during Derek Chauvin's trial that what he did was clearly against, not part of the training he received. That was that was clear. That was the testimony that was provided. But per your point earlier, there are so many other cases which fall into slightly more of a gray area. So are you concerned that the whole against the training part is still a difficult legal standard to get past?
I think that ending qualified immunity does not get rid of many other barriers to relief in these cases. Just to take one example, the Fourth Amendment, which I mentioned a moment ago, as interpreted by the Supreme Court, protects unreasonable uses of force, but it's all based on what the officer perceives at the moment. So what that means in translation is a police officer can shoot someone who is unarmed, who has a cell phone in their hand, or a toy weapon. And if the officer reasonably believed under those circumstances that that person was posing a threat, they may not have violated the Fourth Amendment. They may not have violated the Constitution, and there may be no remedy for them moving forward. And that's just one of many challenges to relief in these cases that continue to exist without qualified immunity.
Mm. Representative Harrod, I've got one more question for you before we have to let you go. You're proposing further reforms in Colorado. Can you tell us more about what you'd like to change?
Absolutely. Well, we're expanding the provisions around ending qualified immunity beyond just local law enforcement, and including the state patrol now as well. Additionally, we are looking to change our use of force standard so that we can have more DAs put forward officers that do harm in our communities and have that criminal responsibility. Additionally, we are looking to restrict and ban the use of ketamine by law enforcement officers. This is being used on the streets as a sedative, and unfortunately, it is killing people. So we are adding that to extreme use of force in our state if they do direct the use of ketamine. And so there's a lot of work going on in Colorado around law enforcement reform, and we will continue those efforts again until we're done. And quite frankly, just like any other industry in Colorado that the legislature oversees and has to regulate, we should continue this work in perpetuity to ensure that law enforcement is held to the standard that we as a community expect them to be.
Well, Representative Leslie Harrod is a Colorado State Representative and Chair of the Colorado Black Democratic Legislative Caucus. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Professor Schwartz, we've got about 4-ish minutes left on the show here today. This has been really fascinating from a legal perspective, but both of you also just talked about deterrence, that changing the law could serve as a or aid in deterring excessive use of force by police officers that harms people. And I just want to play a little bit of tape from the Cato Institute. Again, this is Clark Neely. He's Cato's vice president for criminal justice. And he actually pointed to New York City's recent changes to qualified immunity as a potential model.
Lawyers for the police union in New York City, in response to the city council's elimination of qualified immunity at the city level, sent a letter to the members saying, look, there's no more qualified immunity. Each of you is now individually liable, and you need to be really, really careful not to violate people's rights. That's a really great response. And we're not going to see that kind of response if we go to an employer only, which is to say taxpayer only, liability regime.
So, Joanna Schwartz, first of all, how much has the existence of qualified immunity helped shape police culture? And could the removal of it do what Clark Neely is saying has happened in New York, a change in, if not culture, then at least focus on what police officers do day in and day out?
Qualified immunity, I think, has a lot of insidious effects on police culture. There are all of these high-profile court decisions, Supreme Court decisions with tragic facts with people who have been killed, where the Supreme Court or other federal courts say, too bad, you get no relief. There's no consequence for this officer's conduct. And that's got to send a message. Justice Sotomayor said that the Supreme Court's qualified immunity decisions send a shoot first, think later approach to policing. They endorse that kind of approach. And that's the kind of approach that I think ending qualified immunity would limit. It also would clarify the scope of constitutional protections. Right now, courts can grant qualified immunity without ruling on whether the law was violated. So there are all sorts of kinds of constitutional violations that have not been clearly established, which means that they haven't been clarified to police departments. There are parts of the country where it's not clear whether recording a police officer is constitutionally protected activity. And that's squarely because of qualified immunity. If there is an elimination of qualified immunity, there's going to be more clarity about the law.
Mm. Well, can I just jump in? Because the last 30 seconds, I want to ask one final question, because I'm wondering if there might be listeners out there who are thinking, again, in the case of what happened to George Floyd, there was a criminal trial. There was also a civil settlement with the city, all with no reforms to qualified immunity. So there might be people wondering out there wondering, why do we need these changes at all when there are avenues to justice?
There is a case that I'd like to describe very briefly that I think answers that question. There's a man named Tony Timpa who was put beneath the knee of a Dallas police officer in much the same way that Derek Chauvin killed George Floyd, held there for 14 minutes, and a court in Texas granted those officers qualified immunity because there was no prior court decision with virtually identical facts. We know about George Floyd. The world knows about George Floyd. So his case got a certain type of treatment. But that treatment was not given to Tony Timpa or his family. That's why we need to end qualified immunity.
Joanna Schwartz, professor of law at UCLA, it has been a fascinating hour to spend with you. Thank you so much.
It's my great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.